Chapter 3
"I think I might remember something," Nick said to Kate as they ate Sardinian ravioli at La Pergola, "about the man who might have given my father that SAS parachute."
"I'm all ears," Kate said.
"When I was 10 years old, this friend of my father's came to Miami to visit him. I remember they went into the study and locked the door. Stayed in there for an hour, talking.
And?"
"He had a very British accent. It was the coolest sounding thing in the world to me back then. And he brought me a present from England. It was this gold pin, a sword with wings, and a banner that said, 'Who dares wins.'"
"That's the SAS motto," Kate said.
"Exactly.
Do you remember his name?"
"No, I don't. It was a long time ago. But I remember the name was unusual. Something I might recognize if I saw it again."
A long moment of silence passed between them, until Nick finally spoke again.
"Kate, no matter what my father has done, I don't know if I can help you bring him in."
Kate nodded.
"I understand. But if you and I bring him in, he'll be in cuffs. If Vitali does, it might be a body bag."
Kate and Nick caught the next available flight from Rome to London. A driver was waiting outside Heathrow Airport to take them to the Ministry of Defense Strategic Command Center, a nondescript building down the street from the more famous Thames House, the headquarters of MI5. Kate checked her Glock at the desk, and they went up to the UK Special Forces Office, home base for the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment. SAS, for short.
It was a strangely familiar feeling for Kate, walking among the squad members. This was a different country, different insignias on the sand-colored berets, a different-sounding version of the English language. Yet the energy in the air was exactly the same.
So was the self-assured way everyone carried themselves, and the steely look in everyone's eyes. It took her back to the time she'd spent as a Navy SEAL. Her chestnut-brown hair was several inches longer than when she was a SEAL. It was pulled back into a quick ponytail after her plane ride from Rome. Her jacket was wrinkled and she was wearing an FBI badge, but she felt totally at home.
"I bet anyone in this building could kill us in 3 seconds with a paperclip," Nick said.
"No doubt," Kate said. "And if you don't behave yourself, I'll kill you myself."
A man appeared in the hallway and headed straight for them, a little older than everyone else, but no less imposing. Dress camo, hair cut high and tight.
"I'm Major Hannon," he said, with a West Country version of a British accent. "You must be from the FBI."
"Yes, Major," Kate said, shaking his hand. "I'm Agent O'Hare, and this is Nick Fox."
The Major looked Nick up and down like he couldn't quite understand the FBI connection. Kate didn't blame him. She felt the same way herself several times a day.
"I understand you already have the parachute used in the escape last night," Kate said.
"It just arrived."
Hannon led them down a hallway to an equipment room with enough armament to outfit a small army, which is exactly what they were. Assault rifles, pistols, a wide array of knives on the far wall. Kate couldn't help staring. This was her kind of room.
"It's here," Hannon said, showing them an unfolded parachute draped over a table. "It was already dusted for prints before it was sent here. None were found."
He gathered the featherweight material of the chute and started folding it as he kept talking.
"It's definitely one of ours. But we do mostly halo jumping."
"High altitude, low opening," Kate said to Nick.
"That's right," Hannon said, impressed. "You've jumped before?"
"Once or twice."
"Then I'm sure you used a backup chute and a slider reefing device."
"Yes," Kate said, "of course."
"This one's been modified."
Hannon nodded to the fabric in his hands.
"Quicker release, single shoot with no backup. It's not the kind of thing we usually do here, jumping off buildings."
"Do you know where this chute came from?" Kate asked.
"We've got thousands of these all over the country. This one looks a little older than most. It might have been saved by someone who retired from the regiment. But I'll tell you one thing. Whoever modified this knew exactly what he was doing.
So how do we find out who did this, Major? Kate asked.
We've had a lot of smart men come through this building, Hannon said, and most of them know their way around the parachute. I'm not sure how we're going to narrow this down.
I might have an idea, Nick said.
Nick, Kate, and Hannon sat in a conference room high above the streets of London.
I was 10 years old, Nick said, the man who came to visit us. He gave me an SAS pin.
Hannon listened to every word, and the look on his face made it crystal clear he wasn't buying any of it.
If this man was in the regiment, he never would have said so. That's the first rule.
First rule of Fight Club. Never talk about Fight Club, Nick said.
Hannon looked at him like he had no idea what Nick was talking about.
He didn't say a word about being in the SAS, Nick said. But who else would have a pin like that?
Nobody.
That's what I thought. And you just told us 5 minutes ago that this shoot definitely came from the SAS. So why not follow up on it?
What was this man's name? Hannon asked.
It was a long time ago. But it was an unusual name. Something that sounded funny to me at the time.
I think there's a chance I'd recognize it if I saw it. There's anywhere from 400 to 600 active members at any one time.
If we know the year, can you show me the active roster?
It was obvious Hannon didn't love the idea. He thought it over for a moment and finally gave in. Using the year that Nick was 10 years old, he went off to another room to find the roster.
This sounds like a long shot, Kate said. There must be some other way you can contact your father.
I tried calling him. His phone is dead. I called his neighbor, too, and he said the house has been empty for weeks.
Hannon came back into the room with a roster sheet.
You'll see we're divided into 4 squadrons, he said. Each squadron has 4 troops, led by a captain. The troops have specialties. Mobility, mountain, boat, and air. The air lads use most of the parachutes, no surprise, so that's where I'd start.
Nick went through the names in each squadron list, focusing on the air troops. There were 16 names in each air troop, 64 in all. He stopped and closed his eyes like he was transporting himself back to a 10-year-old version of himself, hearing his father's friend being introduced to him, a friend with a cool British accent and an unusual name.
I'm sorry, he finally said. It's just not jumping out at me.
Hannon took back the list and looked at the names.
Oh, I know most of these men. I'll be honest, Mr. Fox. I find it hard to believe that any one of them would help train your father, much less modify a chute so he could make a clean getaway from a robbery at the Vatican. I'm not surprised you didn't find a name here, because I still don't believe a single word of this.
I understand why you'd say that, Nick said. I'm just going by what I remember.
Memory's a funny thing. I won't hold it against you, sir.
We appreciate your help, Kate said. I'll report to Interpol that you did everything you could for us.
Hannon made an effort not to laugh at that. To him, Interpol was nothing but a bunch of computer geeks and pencil pushers, with tin badges and pop guns.
I'll see you out, he said. And good luck finding your man.
They had booked 2 rooms at a hotel in the West End, near Covent Garden. It was still early in the evening, but they were both exhausted and jet-lagged. Nick passed on a nightcap, and Kate was grateful but suspicious. As soon as Nick was alone in his room, he opened up his laptop and started searching. 30 minutes later, he opened the door quietly, looked up and down the hallway, and stepped very softly past Kate's room, toward the elevator. In another few minutes, he was down on Monmouth Street, hailing a taxi. 30 seconds later, Kate hailed her own, and told the driver to follow the taxi in front of them.
I'm going to kill him, she said.
She kept saying it over and over, until the driver gave her a funny look and she made herself stop. They stayed on Nick's tail, through the city, onto Whitechapel Road. There were a few anxious moments, making their way through the evening traffic and trying to keep in contact with a single taxi that looked like any other.
Finally, Nick's taxi turned down a narrow residential street and came to a stop. Kate watched Nick get out. She threw some pound notes at the driver and did the same. She was a block away, partially hidden in the shadows between street lamps. Now she had a choice to make. Go strangle the man, or wait and watch. She decided to wait and watch. After 5 minutes of standing in the shadows, she started to get that old feeling, which had never failed her, that she was being watched herself. Nick stood down the street from the address he'd given to the driver. The owner of this little row house was a retired SAS captain named Richard Duckworth. It had been half a lie that he didn't know the name. He remembered the man calling himself Ducky. And then that half-lie was followed by a full lie when he scanned the list of names and acted like a man coming up empty. In truth, the name had jumped right out at him, and the fact that he had been the air troop captain for B Squadron clinched it. The man he had met when he was 10 years old, and who might have given his father the parachute, lived in this row house. Nick's first order of business was to come up with a plan, a script, and possibly a character. Or maybe this was the one time when he should play it straight. Just tell the man he was the son of Quentin Fox and needed to talk to him. Because that's really all he was doing here. He felt bad leaving Kate behind. But he was certain that if he could just get 5 minutes with his father alone, he could find out the truth. Without the truth, there was no way to know what to do next. Return the map. Give his dad to the authorities. Or go hunt for treasure. Nick was halfway to the door when it opened. 2 men came out. One was the same model of man he'd seen in the SAS headquarters. Brick wall solid, with a high and tight haircut. He may have been a little older, retired from service, but he couldn't help but carry himself like a soldier. The second man was his father, and he was holding a hard metal tube about a foot long. Nick knew. This had to be the map. Nick followed them several blocks, back to Whitechapel Road. He watched them enter a narrow 2-story building that was tucked into the middle of the block. He gave them a minute, then carefully peeked into the little window set high on the front door. It was a pub, the kind of place meant only for the locals who'd been drinking there for most of their lives. There wasn't even a sign on the front announcing the Bell and Crown or the Stag and Spit Bucket. Nick stepped inside. There was a single rail of a bar running down one side of the room, with a rough-looking bartender on the other side. There was a game of footy on the telly, but nobody else but the bartender was watching it. There was no sign of Nick's father or Duckworth. The bartender stopped wiping a glass, looked at Nick as if he must have gotten himself seriously lost and walked through the wrong door.
"Help you, mate."
"You got a bathroom?" Nick asked. The bartender hesitated, then said,
"Lou's back there."
Nick went down the narrow hallway, found the empty men's room and an empty women's room that was probably never used. He pushed open the 3rd door and scanned the small kitchen. Nobody was here. He pushed open the back door and glanced up and down the filthy alley. Nick was about to go back inside, then stopped himself and looked up at the 2nd-story windows. "How do you get up there?" Nick came back down the hallway into the bar.
"All set, mate," the bartender said.
"How about one quick pint?" Nick said, sitting on one of the stools.
"We'll be closing soon."
"Just one. Then I'll be on my way." The bartender tilted a glass and filled it, put it in front of Nick, then walked to the other end of the bar to watch the match. So much for Nick stalling, making conversation, or anything else that might help him figure out where his father had gone. A minute later, another man walked in. He was wearing an old tweed jacket and a bow tie, but otherwise he looked just as uncomfortable and just as out of place as Nick.
"I'm Professor Lewis," he said to the bartender. "I believe they're expecting me."
The bartender put his rag down.
"Right this way, Professor."
He led Professor Lewis to the hallway. Nick leaned back to watch what was happening, but lost sight of them as they turned the corner. The bartender returned a few seconds later, alone.
"Thank you, sir," Nick said.
"You have a great evening." He threw a few pound notes on the bar and walked out. When he was at the end of the block, he made a right turn, worked his way back to the alley, and found the back door of the pub. He opened it quietly. This time, as he made his way up the hallway, he felt along the surface of the ancient wooden wall. His fingers hit a vertical seam. He kept going until he hit another seam. This could be a hidden door, he thought. He tapped lightly. It sounded hollow. He pressed against one side of the panel, then the other side. From the bar, he heard footsteps approaching the hallway. The bartender's coming back here, Nick thought. Nick pushed on the wall again, higher, then lower. The footsteps were getting closer. He pushed one more time and felt it give. Then the panel slid all the way open and he stepped inside, closing the panel behind him. Kate tailed Nick to Whitechapel Road and watched him go into the little pub with no name. She still couldn't shake the feeling that she was being watched herself. She was about to approach the pub when Nick came back out. She ducked into a doorway, holding her breath as he walked by. A few seconds passed. She poked her head back out, looked down the street. He was gone. Damn, I can't lose him, she thought. Kate hurried down to the end of the block, but still didn't see him. She guessed to the right, went in that direction, came to the alley and spotted Nick. She darted back just in time to avoid being made. When she peeked around the corner, he had disappeared again. Kate went down the alley and found the back door to the pub. He must have gone in here, she thought. But why? He just walked out the front door a minute ago. She cracked open the door, in time to see the bartender leaving the men's room. Moving down the hallway, she stopped for one moment, pushed the men's door open. The bathroom was empty. Kate continued into the bar. The bartender was wiping down some glasses and looked over at her like, what the hell? Where is he? She asked him. Where's who, love? The man who came in here.
He wasn't here more than a minute, the bartender said, and he was on his way.
Kate came closer to the bar, took out her FBI badge. With no official jurisdiction, no official reason for this guy to give her the time of day, she knew she'd have to really sell this next part. I'm going to ask you again, she said, flashing the shield. Where is he? The bartender looked at the badge, his world clearly not rocked one tiny bit. I think we've already covered it, love. Your men came in and left. He snuck around to the alley and came in the back door. He's not in the bathroom. So where is he? The bartender stopped, smiling. Bloody hell, he said, throwing down his bar rag and moving quickly to the hallway. Nick stood motionless inside the doorway. He waited for the sound of footsteps to end, let out his breath, and turned toward the stairs behind him. A dim glow of light was coming from somewhere above. He heard voices. Nick couldn't quite make out what they were saying. He took a step on the old boards, winced at the squeak, then kept going.
Auf dem Thron, Deutschland siegt auf allen Fronten, he heard one voice say.
It sounded like the professor who had just come in.
On the tower, Germany is victorious on all fronts, the man said. Which makes sense, because those were the exact words hanging on the tower. They cut the cables, you know, so that nobody could use the lift. They didn't want someone to sneak up and cut the banner down. Are you saying that's where the treasure is? It was Nick's father's voice. That's impossible. I'm just telling you what I see here, Lewis said. These runes in the center section, they call them the Elder Futhark. They go back to the 8th century. It's a code, very common for the Nazis. Hitler was obsessed with the occult, with astrology, ancient symbols, omens.
Nick stayed frozen where he was, listening intently.
Can you decipher the code? His father asked. I need to see more of it. Are there other documents?
Before Nick could hear another word, the hidden door opened behind him. He turned to see the bartender, with Kate standing beside him. Nick didn't have more than 1 second to react when he heard a riot of heavy footsteps coming through the front door of the pub. Kate pushed the bartender toward the back door, pulled the Glock from her belt, and aimed it down the hallway. A bullet passed over her head and dug into the doorway. She returned fire.
Move, she said, coming up toward Nick. As Nick hit the top of the stairs, the three men in the room were already in motion. Duckworth had his own semi-automatic drawn and Quentin Fox was rolling up the map, while the professor just looked like he was deciding which window to jump out of. Quentin pushed open another secret door on the far wall, grabbed the professor by his tweed coat and pulled him through. Duckworth aimed his barrel at Nick.
Don't move, he said. I'll put one right through your eye hole.
Captain, it's me, Nick said, raising his hands. I'm Quentin's son. Duckworth froze, trying to understand what he was hearing. Kate flew into the room, firing back down the staircase. Get down, she said. Nick took cover behind the upended table, but Duckworth was an old SAS man and there was only one thing he knew how to do. He joined Kate at the top of the stairs and fired down at the intruders. Who are they? He asked Kate between rounds. I was hoping you could tell me. One of the men tried to come up the stairs. Duckworth kept the eyehole promise he'd made to Nick and put one through the man's left eye. When the man went down, another appeared from behind him. He sprayed bullets wildly, one of them hitting Duckworth under his arm. Kate took aim and fired, killing the second intruder.
Get out of here, Duckworth said. Through that door. I'll hold them.
Kate pushed Nick ahead through the other secret door. It led to another staircase, this one caked with dust and cobwebs, obviously not used for years. They followed the two sets of footprints down to a door that had already been pushed open. They emerged in the alley behind the pub. Another man fired on them immediately. Kate took dead aim and put one into his chest.
Which way did they go? Kate asked Nick.
Nick saw one set of dusty footprints leading in one direction, another set in the opposite direction.
Both ways.
Kate grabbed the gun that the man in the alley had just dropped. She got her first good look at the man. Saw nothing more remarkable than his raw, stubbled face, his thick sweater and heavy boots, like a dock worker would wear. There was a tattoo on his neck, a hint of something red barely peeking out from under his collar, but Kate had no time to examine it. Here, she said to Nick, handing him the gun.
You go that way.
It was one of Nick's oldest rules to never touch a gun if he didn't have to. But today was a great day to make an exception. He gripped it in firing position, finger off the trigger, and headed left down the alley as Kate went in the opposite direction. As Kate drew nearer to the alley's opening to the street, she saw one of the men who'd been in the upper room, now splashing through the filthy puddles just ahead of her. It wasn't Quentin Fox, but rather the third man, the one with the tweed jacket and the bow tie. He ran out onto the street, but before Kate could reach the same opening, it was blocked by the largest man she had ever seen in her life. And he had a gun. She dove behind a garbage bin as the huge man fired on her. She fired back and caught him high in the right shoulder. The man barely flinched. He kept firing until he finally ran out of bullets. The big man came toward her, as if Kate being armed meant nothing to him. But then someone called to him from the street. He turned and left the alley. When Kate caught up, she saw him getting into a black van. He had left a thin trail of blood from where she'd hit him in the shoulder. She turned and looked back down the alley, but saw no sign of either Fox, father or son. Nick emerged from the alley and spotted his father running across Whitechapel Road. He gave chase, dodging oncoming cars, catching sight of him again as he entered a park. He lost him, almost gave up, until he finally saw him running toward a pedestrian bridge. Nick's lungs were burning as he reached the bridge. He stood at the apex, which gave him a good view of the rest of the park. He saw nothing but trees, the darkness broken only by a few more street lamps and a dozen people walking calmly. Nobody running.
Where did you go, Dad? He asked out loud.
Nick leaned over the edge of the pedestrian bridge, taking long breaths of the cold evening air. On the street directly below him, opening the door to a taxi, was his father. He was holding the metal cylinder containing the map. Quentin Fox sensed the presence above him, looked up, and saw Nick staring down at him. The two men were frozen like this for several seconds. Nick still had the gun in his hand. He could have pointed it at his father, ordered him to stop. He could have shot the gun into the air. He could have put a bullet into the taxi's hood,
scaring the driver out of his vehicle and drawing the attention of everyone around him, including the police. He didn't do any of those things. He kept staring into his father's eyes until the driver honked his horn. Quentin nodded to Nick, got into the back with his treasure map, and then the taxi drove away.